Very fitting for the Blind Boys of Alabama to be playing there in the background. First of all, we just went and saw them perform last night in town. And, you know, one of the many groups out there very angry with President Kennedy were those who were not happy with the civil rights movement of the day. And, of course, we lost Mr. Kennedy, and then we lost Martin Luther King. And during one of Bobby Kennedy's speeches, he was informed that Martin Luther King had just been shot. And all the states around erupted into this crazy violence except where he was. Yeah. He had the most magical speech at that moment. Mm. And we posted that as our video of the week. If you want to go to drewmarshall.ca and click on DrewTube, you'll see that video right there. And powerful.
That monument that they've got erected in that spot is even more powerful.
We just got off the phone with Vincent Bugliosi, who really has written, I would say, the most definitive work on President Kennedy's assassination, a 1,600-page book with another 1,000 pages, I believe, in a CD. And it's always great to have Mr. Bugliosi on the line with us. It's a very interesting interview. But I really wanted to speak with someone who was on the ground that day. I don't know. I feel very privileged and very honored to have come across a gentleman named Paul Landis. He is a retired Secret Service agent assigned to the JFK detail on that day. And we have him on the line right now. Mr. Landis, sir, can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can.
Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. So,
I know from our previous conversation and from reading and watching some things online that this is fairly recent for you to be able to speak openly about that day. It really took the wind out of your sails for many, many years, did it not?
Yes, it did. So, really, only for about the last 3 years that I've felt comfortable talking at all.
So. Well, that, of course, makes it all the more special for us. I don't have you here to ask you all the, you know, what do you think happened kind of questions. I just want to know what happened to you and what did you notice? What did you see? Because that's really all you can tell us is your experience. So let's go right to that day. You were, if I understand things right, and looking at some photographs, were you not sort of standing on the right step rail or whatever that is called on the right side of the car behind the Kennedy limousine?
Yes, that was a follow-up car, and it's a running board like cars used to have.
Right. And from your position, I mean, your job at that point in time as you're driving through the Dallas area is to stare out into the crowd and kind of be looking for someone doing something a little suspicious. Is that right?
Correct. Anybody trying to approach the limousine, watching to see if we could catch a glimpse of anything, anybody's hands, anything unusual.
Right. And the moment you heard the first shot, you were simply doing that, just looking out into the crowd? It was almost like any other motorcade that you'd been on. Or had you been on other presidential motorcades?
No, that was my first motorcade.
Okay. Boy, that's some bad luck, isn't it? Jeez. So you're looking out into the crowd, and then take us through what happened as you experienced it, Mr. Landis.
Well, I've been scanning buildings as we made the turn on Houston Street, and I didn't particularly see anything. I was starting to scan ahead. I was watching the crowd at the corner when we made our left turn onto Dealey Plaza. And just after we made the turn and the cars started almost were straightening out, I heard a loud report, which I immediately in my mind knew or identified as a high-powered rifle shot. And I turned and looked over my shoulder to the right. I didn't see anything. I was looking at the building. I immediately dropped down, my eyes down, and started scanning the crowd, looking forward. We had an overpass that we were approaching, which was ahead. I scanned there. didn't see anything. I looked at the president. I noticed he was kind of leaning a little to the left, but I didn't associate anything there with anything being wrong. I thought maybe he'd been looking to see where the sound had come from. I looked at the car, his car, the tires, to see if there was some sort of blowout. At some point there, I had heard another noise, which I wasn't sure whether it was an echo from we were like in a tunnel with something coming from the overpass ahead, and didn't see anything. And then just as I looked at the president again, there was a third shot, and I saw his head explode, and we were off to the races and to Parkland. I knew right away that the president, there was no way he could survive that kind of a shot.
Let me ask you, Mr. Landis, why did you, I mean, this is going to sound like a very obvious question, but why did you turn to the right and not look straight ahead of you? Because you know where this question is going. The theories out there that he was shot from the front, but you were behind the president and you turned around to your right because you heard that's where you thought the shot came from?
The shot came from over my right shoulder.
Right.
I mean, there was no doubt that, and everybody, I think, in the file-off car, we all turned to look that way.
After you raced off and went to the hospital, Your most vivid memory at the hospital. Tell us about that.
Pretty much chaos. Reason I was in Dallas, well, with Clint Hill and I were assigned to Mrs. Kennedy. That's why we were there, because she decided to go on a trip. When we went into Parkland, entrance lobby there to the emergency room, it was kind of crowded, a lot of people. Coming in to see what was going on. I just hollered, clear everybody out, get everybody away. I didn't want anybody standing around gawking or bothering Mrs. Kennedy. Clint Hill had gone into the trauma room one with the president's body, which was on a gurney then, and I just stayed with Mrs. Kennedy. I made sure I didn't want anybody talking to her or bothering her. I just to make sure she was left alone.
But did you and Mrs. Kennedy speak at all at the hospital?
We did not really speak at all to each other. We got a chair for her to sit down outside the trauma room. We did not talk.
You must remember her sitting in that chair in the hospital and just staring off.
It was kind of like staring off. I was kind of assumed she was in shock. I think we all might have been operating in shock.
Sure. Well, and then, of course, the president was declared dead at 1 o'clock, and his body eventually, I know there was some confusion as to what the legalities were in Dallas at that day, but eventually his body is carried up into Air Force One. I had heard somewhere that in order to get the casket in that back door, going up those stairs was just unbelievably difficult. But in order to get the casket in the back door, the handrails needed to be taken off?
The handles, yeah. The casket was very heavy and awkward, and agents were carrying it up the stairs, and they got to the door, and it would not fit through. So they ended up having to break the handles off to get it in. And the crew on Air Force One had cleared some seats in the back to give space to put the casket in.
And you were there during the swearing-in of Lyndon Johnson?
Yes, I was. So I witnessed that from the doorway.
I know there was no love lost between, I guess, Lyndon Johnson's gang and the Kennedy gang, and you were of course, loyal and quite honorably so faithful to Jackie Kennedy. She was your assignment. Any weird feelings? Do you remember any weird feelings at all when they were swearing in Mr. Johnson?
No, I don't. I don't really don't remember any. I mean, at that time, once we got in Air Force One, I completely broke down. I didn't remember too much of the flight back to Andrews Air Force Base, other than when somebody told me to come back to the doorway and witness. I said, "You're going to be witnessing history here. You got to see it, Paul."
No time to grieve, really. No, and no counseling back in those days.
That didn't exist. We kept all our feelings inside. Clint and I traveled. I stayed in the Secret Service for another 6 months. Clint and I remained with Mrs. Kennedy. We did not talk about the assassination at all. I don't think any of the agents that I knew then talked, and we were just too busy. We really didn't have time. There weren't that many people assigned to the White House then, and Mrs. Kennedy kept busy traveling and doing things, and we went with her, and it was just, we had to work, and there was no time to take a break or grieve or even think about it. Plus, I mean, I felt, you know, we're Secret Service agents. We're supposed to be tough and be able to handle this kind of thing. So you didn't let it show.
Some people have, you know, I guess they've just come out and said the Secret Service failed. But the things that I've looked into recently would suggest that the Secret Service didn't have enough manpower to do what needed to be done. You didn't have the technology of today. You didn't have the budget of today. So, and look, I know as men, when we're charged with a responsibility, especially of someone else, and something happens to that person, we take that ownership strongly. I mean, we really, that hits us hard. But when someone says the Secret Service failed that day, how does that make you feel?
Well, in a way, they're right, because we did lose a president, and it was our responsibility to guard and protect him and the First Lady and the First Family. You can't deny that we failed, but maybe it brings up a little guilt feeling, but just under the circumstances and the day and everything, that there really wasn't much we could do. Lee Oswald, everything went his way that day. It just was one of those things that I think was a freak circumstance. That, I mean, just how the whole thing played out.
Mm-hmm. So. Why did you resign?
From the stress was... I felt guilty and thought I had failed on the job, that I'd let the other agents down, that I'd let the country down. It was mainly guilt. I said, I kind of told myself, I will give myself 6 months and see how I feel then. During those 6 months, traveling with Mrs. Kennedy while she was grieving, I drove her in the car. There was a lot of crying on her part, a lot of mourning, and wherever we went, people were gawking and there to see, and it was just like, why can't they leave this lady alone and let her grieve in private? I understand, you know, it's like movie star quality or whatever. People are interested in seeing these people. But it just, I didn't feel any better after 6 months, and I said, okay, I can't take this anymore. And that's it. So I keep my word or hold it, and that was like, I said 6 months, and that's it. I'm moving on.
Mr. Landis, I know one person who was sad that you retired. Do you know a fellow named Ron Pontius?
Yes.
He told me that it was a loss for the Secret Service the day you retired.
Well, that's very kind of him to say that.
Well, I think he should. I think he should say it again right now, Mr. Pontius.
Yeah, sure.
Mr. Landis is on the other line. I understand the two of you got together a few years ago, and Mr. Landis didn't know I was going to do this, but we thought we'd kind of surprise you and put Ron on the phone with you. Ron, Paul?
Yeah, Paul, how are you?
Hey, I'm hanging in there, Ron. How are you?
That's good. You know, what you were saying, it was very hard. I was busy with the new president doing advance work and everything else, took my mind off it. But you were still with the tragedy for a full 6 months, so that was a big difference.
Let me just bring our listeners up to speed here. Ron, you, of course, were with the Secret Service as well, and you had gone ahead of everyone, if I understand things right, and sort of set things up in Dallas ahead of Mr. Kennedy's visit.
No, I was in charge of Houston.
Oh, Houston. Okay, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
They had my stop the night before.
Got it. Got it. But when Mr. Kennedy was actually assassinated, you were in the air. Was that right?
That's right. We were coming in. Our plane was coming in. Well, my boss had me coming back. He says, take a night. You got Friday night off, and Saturday you're leaving 8 o'clock Sunday morning for Salt Lake City. So I was the quickest I could get was a flight out, and I remember it was Braniff Airlines, and we were approaching Washington National Airport, and the winds were coming from the northwest, so you fly along the river, and we couldn't have been, it was on the approach looking out over Alexandria, and all of a sudden the pilot announced we just had, it hadn't been confirmed, but we just had a notice that the president's been shot in Dallas. I said, oh my gosh. So that's when I found out about it, and of course I got a cab and went straight home and called the office, but you picked up the phone, the exchange was dead. So many people were calling, so many people, and we had a private number to call, emergency number, and I called that one, I got in. So.
Wow.
That's all I knew about it.
Sure.
And, the boss told me, he says, come on into the White House, and you're going out to Andrews Air Force Base. And do the advance for the return of the body of President Kennedy and President Lyndon Johnson. And that's my episode for that day.
How often would the two of you work together? Paul, do you remember working with Ron much?
Well, not a whole lot, but I remember seeing Ron a lot. But remember, I was assigned either to the children or the First Lady.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing our thing while the president was off doing his thing.
Tell us, well, you can both chirp in on this. I'm very interested to know about this reunion, I guess, so to speak, that you all had for the book that Mr. Blaine was putting together. Was that the first time you had gotten together in however many years?
Yes, that was the first time we ever got together and spoke about JFK's assassination. It's one thing we never talked about. I had been to quite a few annual conventions that we had, and it was a subject no one brought up.
And, of course, this book called, I think it was called Kennedy Detail, was it not?
That's correct. They
yeah.
made a documentary on it, and Paul and I were invited to participate in the documentary. And so we met down in Dallas, and that was actually the first time we spoke about the assassination.
And, Paul, do you remember, you know, that moment where all of a sudden you guys are all together again and you started talking about it and you were sharing how you felt and what your experience was, et cetera, et cetera? And do you remember that moment, Paul, where all of a sudden you sat there and went, that's exactly how I feel?
I do. Do remember that, and I was just absolutely amazed that every one of us there had the same feelings, and the guilt, I guess, and everything, and that was a big relief for me, because I thought, and probably we all felt the same way, and we just didn't want to talk about that.
Hmm.
It was just something we felt you don't talk about.
Let's finish this conversation. And by the way, Paul, I hope you're okay with the fact that we surprised you by having Ron join us on the phone.
I am very pleased. I'm glad. It's nice to hear his voice. I look forward to the next reunion that we can get together, hopefully.
Yeah.
I then wanted to tell him I spent two nice days with Clint up in Dearborn, Michigan this week. So he's looking good and doing great.
Boy, I tell you, you guys must be sick of seeing Clint's face on the TV all this week. He's just about done every news media thing out there.
Then and then some. So, yeah, busy guy these days.
It certainly seems like it. Of course, we're talking about Clint Hill, who was the agent we saw in the Zapruder film and other images, jumped up on the back of the Kennedy car, the presidential car. And I guess he and Mrs. Kennedy, of course, connected there. And as I understand it, the job of Secret Service in this sort of incident is to cover and evacuate. Cover and evacuate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Let's finish with your brief comments, your brief recollections of both Mr. Kennedy, President Kennedy, and Mrs. Kennedy. And maybe we'll start with you, Ron. Did you ever have any sort of, many direct encounters with the Kennedy family?
Yes, I did. I had worked under President Eisenhower beforehand, and then when President Kennedy came in, it was a new generation. And I felt that, I was just another agent, but when they dedicated O'Hare Field in Chicago, I asked the president, there was a VIP area on the right. I was the shift agent in charge, but they were dedicating the memorial at the airport, and I said, Mr. President, you have time to say hello to my family and my mom and dad? And he said, yeah, where are they? And I said, right here at the end of VIP area. He walked past everybody. And before I could get there to say, this is Mrs. Pontius, he says, Mrs. Pontius, how are you, Mr. Pontius? So I said, oh, my gosh, she knows my last name. And then he was saying, Ron does a good job. Ron does a good job. So he met my mom, dad, and one of my brothers and my sister.
Wow. Wow.
And then going home on the expressway, it's Kennedy Expressway now, but it was Northwest Expressway. My sister-in-law was there at the side, and she's yelling and screaming up there, Ron, Ron, Ron. And the president turned around to see who the heck, instead of saying the president, all of a sudden something different, screaming for Ron. And the next morning, we were leaving the Hilton Hotel, and I asked the president again, I said, Mr. President, you have a moment to say hi to my brother? He's a policeman here. And he said, yes, where is he? Right here. And so he walked over and grabbed his hand, shook hands with him, and he spoke to him for about, he fired one question after another. And then I remember later on in the day, I forget when it was, he said, Ron, do you know everyone in this town or what? I said, no, I was just born and raised here.
Oh.
He knew my name. He called my name. He knew my last name. Impressive.
Great stories. Great stories. What about you, Paul?
Well, my first encounter, I didn't have a big family. I was a bachelor alone in Washington. But my first, after he was inaugurated in the first 3 months of his administration, I was assigned to the White House detail. And the first encounter I had, I was assigned by the Rose Garden, the entrance going into the mansion, and I saw him coming by, and he was walking with somebody and talking and not really paying much attention, and I opened the door, and he came through, and I said, just nodded my head and said, Mr. President, and he nodded back and went on. The next time I saw him, he said, Mr. Landis, how are you today? And I was so impressed that he'd gone to the trouble to find out who I was, and it was like he was that way, I think, with all the agents. He made an effort to go out of his way to get to know them, to know who was there.
A special man, of course, is what we're hearing. Now, your time was spent more with Mrs. Kennedy.
I spent 3 months on the White House detail there, and then I was assigned to Caroline and John. And I was with them a little over a year. And then Mrs. Kennedy came back from a trip to India with her sister, and Ron was on that trip. And it came back, and the agent assigned to her detail was given a different assignment, and Clint Hill, who had been working with them, was given, you know, taken charge of her detail. And then he asked me if I wanted to come on board with him. So that's how that all came about.
Well, look, I just want to say a couple things before we say goodbye here. First of all, Mr. Pontius and Mr. Landis, you know what, look, this is going to sound so condescending and so trite and so radio guy made up, but you got to know, and I don't know whether it makes any difference at all, but, you know, as a generation, as a people, as a society, as North Americans, just as myself, having read and studied and done a boatload of research on this, you know, we bear absolutely no ill will towards you. None whatsoever. And it just shows the character that you guys are. You're not looking for glory. You're not wanting to be in the spotlight. As a matter of fact, you know, Mr. Landis, you have avoided the spotlight ferociously.
Yes, I have.
So, again, this all goes to the kind of guys you are. And we're missing that generation of men who shut up, get her done, and aren't looking for glory and the spotlight and that sort of thing. And along with that, you gentlemen know, it comes, I guess, a bit of a tendency to beat yourself up. And so, you know, I'm just a young guy. What do I know? But please just let me have this moment to say thank you. Thank you for the job you did. I know that feels weird for someone to say that to you, but I don't know what I would have done. None of us know what we would have done. And hindsight is 20/20, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, all of that is to say, what an honor to speak to both of you today. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you, Drew. That's a real compliment.
Yeah, Drew, thank you very much. And thank you for the pleasant surprise having Ron on. It's really great to talk and hear your voice, Ron.
Okay. You too, Paul.
I hope you guys keep in touch more than you have, all right? Be better about that, will you? I'd like a phone call a week. Gentlemen, again, thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
There you go, folks. Paul Landis, retired Secret Service agent assigned to JFK's detail on the day of the shooting, was, of course, standing on the rail on the side, the right side of the car, and witnessed that final fatal bullet that struck Mr. Kennedy. And his partner, Ron Pontius, also another retired Secret Service agent who was involved in matters that day as well. Kind of fun to have both those guys on the phone at the same time. It was a good little surprise. Hey, folks, I want to tell you about the Drew Marshall Show 1250 special. You ready for this? For $12.50, that's right, only $12.50, we'll mention your organization's name, website, and a brief description. Did you catch that? During each show, we'll read out your organization's name, website, and a brief description for only $12.50. Now, obviously, there's no point in doing that only once during a four-hour show, so we'll read your advertisement four times per show for an entire month, and each time we do it, it'll only cost you $12.50. It's kind of like putting an advertisement up on every church bulletin in the GTA, except you don't have to get permission from that grumpy old lady at the front desk. Now look, because there are limited spots available for our 1250 special, why don't you call us right now, toll-free, on 877-JOY-1250. Now sure, we're right in the middle of things here in the show, but if you call us right now, toll-free, on 877-JOY-1250, we'll take your name and number and call you back on Monday to sign up for the Drew Marshall Show 1250 special. This is nuts. Are you sure we want to do this? How am I supposed to make any money?